Welcome to Bombshell. I'm Erin Simpson.
I'm Lauren DeYoung-Schulman.
And I'm Radha Iyengar.
And we're again on a distributed edition, even though I am back in D.C. for the weekend. And I think maybe I am drinking some of the rosé that Lauren brought me yesterday. So thanks to Lauren for that. But we are all in our separate abodes with separate recording rigs, which is always an adventure for us. Ladies, what are you drinking?
I'm just having coffee, like a whole lot of coffee, after having apparently reformatted multiple SD cards and shocked myself on electrical equipment this morning. So it's going great. Everything's great. Everything's great.
I'm having a delicious clementine flavored organic Italian soda. So I'm trying to balance the needs of drinking something bubbly and getting vitamin C. And I'm going to tell myself that clementine flavored soda has lots of vitamin C. Go with me, guys.
Come on. I think it certainly does. I can't imagine a single better source for vitamin C, except maybe this rosé that I'm drinking.
That's probably right. That's right.
I'm sure it has lots.
Outstanding. Well, we have a lot to cover this week, but I think first and foremost in my mind has been drama surrounding Iran. And so we decided we would take kind of an extended tour through Iranian tensions and ongoing issues with a special guest. Please welcome Ariane Tabatabai, who's an associate political scientist at RAN. Hi, Ari. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
All right, so maybe we want to start a little bit back at the beginning.
At the very, very beginning, Erin, we have to do our bombshell questions.
Oh my goodness, you are so right. I always forget those. Please, Lauren, lead us off on the bombshell questions.
Our guests work so hard to prepare on these. Okay, first question, Ari, what do you follow like a sport that is not a sport?
So I follow the opposite of sport, which is the DC food scene, which is, as you guys know, pretty dynamic. There's always a lot going on. And we sadly have missed a bunch of restaurants recently that closed down and a few that have opened up. So that's what I follow.
That's a great answer. I'm really loving this question, Lauren. I just have to say.
It's so one of excellent. My favorites. If you could pitch a show to Netflix, what would it be?
I had to think long and hard about this one. I was a cinema major in a previous life and worked in editing. So I was like, I have to really nail this one. But then I ended up going with the answer that is pretty relevant to what you guys were talking about before with cocktails and drinks. I would pitch something like Top Chef, but for mixologists. Right? I would want to watch that.
Yeah.
I've gone into mixing drinks recently and learned a bunch of stuff. Yesterday, I made my first egg white cocktail ever, which I was very excited about. And so I thought that, you know, the sort of the best thing would be to have top mixologists. You know, you can try specific liquors, you can do different colors, you can do episodes with smoke, episodes with like a twist on a classic, new pairings with food and so on and so forth. So that's what I would want to watch.
I would like to have a move out day challenge, a clean out the bar cart challenge where you're like, here's what we have, folks. Triple sec, scotch, Luxardo, and club soda. What do you got?
You know, if you do that and if you end up doing an episode like that, I would like to be reinvited and I will contribute my own bottles.
All right. Who is your fictional or literary hero?
So this was a challenging one for me, not because I don't read, but because I've been reading a lot of nonfiction for the past few years. And so I had to dig really hard and go back all the way to high school. I grew up in France. And so one of the books we read in high school was The Stranger by Albert Camus. And the main character, Meursault, is someone I sort of associated with, I guess, at 16. I was pretty grumpy, so was he. and so that I think that is one of the characters that has left a lot of impact on my life.
Guys, I feel like this is going to be really informative for us when we talk about Iran in a few minutes.
All right, what is your favorite algorithm?
Okay, so I'm really ashamed to admit this, and I feel like I'm one of those people who empowers the tech companies slowly but surely kind of taking over our lives. But Instagram has this thing where if you look up certain things, it just kind of keeps suggesting similar products, similar things to you. And so I have had a ton of really interesting products I'd never heard of before or brands that I didn't know about pop up on my Instagram. And I'm really ashamed to admit this, but I have bought quite a few things I did not need while watching Game of Thrones at like 9:30 p.m. and trying to avoid watching somebody getting their eye poked at. So
That's fabulous.
It's a shameful admission.
And very on point for today's conversation. That's great.
That's amazing.
I'm not going to lie. Amazon really... it knows me better than my husband. I mean, it knows what I want deep down in my heart way that I don't.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They've gotten so much better. Like, my Facebook ads used to be, I guess they, like, looked at pictures of me from when I was pregnant. And, like, I would get these ads about, like, you know, if you have morbid obesity, here's how to lose weight. I'm kind of like, this is actually not helpful, but thanks. And the other one I got was about how to surprise your husband when he comes back from deployment. With like the new you, and I'm not married to a service member, so I'm not really sure where that one came from, but they've gotten so much better and I get like facial products and fancy bras and shoes. So I appreciate these algorithms for all that they're terrifying.
Yeah. And apparently a side of here are some body issues, body image issues
right,
you didn't
exactly.
have, but now you won't have those.
Right.
Fantastic. Okay, now we're going to slide into the topic of the day. Thank you, Lauren, for reminding me of the actual items on our agenda. I'm kind of like Ron Burgundy. If I don't write it down in my show notes, it doesn't happen. And so I often forget to like write down the bombshell questions. So I have spent most of the last week, well, one, in moving boxes, moving, but two, wondering why everyone is so freaked out about Iran this week. Like, why this week and not last week? Why this month and not last month? Et cetera, et cetera. So we want to dig into that, but I think maybe it's useful to sort of scene set and go back a bit. And maybe the right, you tell me, but maybe the right point of departure is Trump administration announcement to leave the JCPOA, the Iran nuclear deal. That seems to be a big part of what's going on now. But we have some genuine security concerns, some genuine threats posed by Iran to interest in the region and to allies and partners in the region. So maybe you can help us, Ari, just scene set a little bit with, in general, why the U.S. worries about Iran and kind of what's brought us to this particular tension point at the moment.
Yeah, so I mean, Iran is a complex question, right? It is in the NDS and the NSS, as part of four countries that we are concerned about. And those four countries, as a reminder, are Russia, China, the DPRK, and Iran. All of those countries, except for Iran, have at least one thing in common, which is nuclear weapons. And Iran does not have those. China is a major economy, a major U.S. competitor. Russia is an important conventional force. The DPRK obviously has nuclear weapons. And so they all have these challenge, these very sort of tangible challenges that they pose to the U.S. And it's pretty understandable why they would be areas of concern for the United States, for DOD. Iran is in a bit of a different bucket. It doesn't have nuclear weapons, though it has had a nuclear program for several decades now. And at least at different times in throughout the past few decades, it has experimented with designing and developing a nuclear device. It's also developed a ballistic missile program, which has become a very big source of concern for U.S. partners in the region. To some degree, the Europeans a bit less so. But I think the most important thing that it has is what we refer to as the Iranian Threat Network, the ITN, which is this group or several groups rather, non-state actors, terrorists. Groups, militias that Iran supports throughout the region. And these include Hezbollah, Hamas, back in the day, the Northern Alliance in Afghanistan, and today the Houthis and the Shia militias in Iraq. So through these different groups, Iran has been able to project power throughout the region. It's built significant influence in various countries, key theaters that are important for the United States, Afghanistan, Iraq, and more recently, Syria and Yemen. And so because of this, Iran is actually able to play an outsized role relative to its actual conventional capabilities, which are have been degrading for the past 40 years. The Iranian military itself is no longer really getting the weapons and the equipment that it once did prior to the revolution. But it has been able to make up for all of these by building asymmetric forces and a strategy that has allowed it to compete with the United States and the region.
That's an excellent, excellent overview. Okay, so what's happened in the last month or so to get everyone's knickers in a twist?
Yeah, so a lot of stuff has happened over the past month. Well, first of all, you know, you mentioned that earlier on, the United States withdrew from the JCPOA last year on May 8th, 2018. President Trump, for the first year and a half of his tenure, had essentially said that he wanted to withdraw from the deal. He had actually campaigned on it. It was one of the few concrete foreign policy ideas that we had that had emerged in the campaign, in the Trump campaign. So President Trump withdrew from the deal a year ago, and then on May the 8th, 2019, so about 2 weeks ago, the Iranian president, Hassan Rouhani, announced that his country was finally going to start taking some steps to test the limits of the nuclear deal. Prior to that, for the past year, the Iranians had been largely implementing the deal. They had tried to stick to the limits of the deal on a number of issues. And the IAEA, their National Atomic Energy Agency, had confirmed that the Iranians were implementing the nuclear provisions.
And so they were doing that kind of in conjunction with the Europeans, who had remained signatories, right? So we had the U.S. had left, but the deal more or less was remaining in effect, even though the U.S. had it reimposed some pretty significant sanctions.
But the sanction waivers remained in effect until the beginning of May, actually.
Also correct.
That's right. Yes.
Secondary sanctions.
So the Iranians essentially wanted to continue engaging the Europeans. They were hoping that the Europeans would at least make up for the U.S. withdrawal from the deal, that they would work with Iran to help give Iran the economic recovery that it wants, which is really at the heart of the JCPOA and the nuclear talks for Iran. The Iranians, you know, came to the table in large part to try to rebuild their economy, which had been devastated under U.S. sanctions. So for the past year, the Europeans had been trying, so had the Russians and the Chinese, but the Iranians were not satisfied with how things were going. And they had threatened in the past that they would resume certain activities, but they hadn't done it. On May 8th, Rouhani announced that the Iranians were finally going to start taking steps. And that made everyone very nervous, including the Europeans, but including the United States, which until that point had the benefit of neither being in the deal, but also benefiting from Iran being limited in its nuclear activities. The other thing that has happened is that a few weeks before this announcement, President Trump announced that he was designating the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, the IRGC, as a foreign terrorist organization. The IRGC is a branch of the Iranian military. They have two branches, really, the conventional forces, they're called the Artesh, and paramilitary force that was created with the revolution, and that's the IRGC, which is responsible for a lot of Iran's activities outside of its borders. The designation was actually very controversial, including with experts here in the U.S. who are not, you know, doves on Iran, who are not known to be soft on Iran. And the reason is that it's uncharted territory.
It's a state actor.
It's a state actor. We've never done this before. We don't know what the implications are going to be. And so many had warned that if we ended up designating the IRGC, that it could actually open up a bunch of conflicts, that it could lead to escalation with Iran. And that's largely what we've seen over the past couple of weeks. So the two major events that have led to all of these activities are the announcement on the JCPOA and the RGC designation.
That is very thorough. Again, thank you. Okay, so Radha, Lauren, what else do we need to know here?
Okay, so now here we are. We've designated the IRGC. We're not in the Iran deal. Iran is restarting nuclear weapons, restarting some of the testing of its nuclear program, sort of consistent with the end of the Iran deal. How much should we actually worry about sort of U.S. foreign policy provoking Iranian additional response, sort of escalating? How much do we think there's an actual risk of going to war here? And how much do we think that actually makes sense in the current context, given where we are?
Well, let's start with the second question, which I think is a lot easier. It makes no sense, right, for the United States to go to war with Iran. If our stated objective and our view is that we're entering a new era of great power competition, if we want to be focusing on Russia and China, which to me makes a lot of sense, then sort of getting, again, distracted by low-hanging fruit, I guess, in the Middle East does not make a whole lot of sense. But there are individuals within the administration who have a long track record of advocating for preemptive strikes against Iran. I'm thinking, obviously, of John Bolton, who has written a lot on the topic, who has long advocated for a more muscled sort of response to Iran. And so the problem seems to be, at least the challenge seems to be, that there is a lot of internal debate within the administration about what to do next and where we go from here. The interesting thing has been that the Iranians too have been signaling that they don't want a conflict, that they do not think the United States wants a conflict, and they've been trying to de-escalate in some ways. But we have very few channels of communication with Iran, none really that is direct, you have a lot of misperception that exists between the two countries, a lot of distrust as well between the two countries for historical reasons that we can get into. And so my concern is not necessarily that President Trump or the Iranian leaders necessarily want to enter into a conflict, but rather that we may have some sort of miscalculation, some kind of misinterpretation of something, of some event that could drag us into a conflict.
You mentioned the divisions within the administration in terms of how to approach Iran right now. But I'm also curious, within the past week, we've seen some divisions between the United States and our allies, particularly the UK, and how they are interpreting potential escalatory measures by Iran. Obviously, there's the wide divergence with our allies in terms of how approaching the JCPOA. So I'm first curious about what you make of how the United States is discussing potential threats and escalation by Iran versus how the UK has put out statements saying, like, we don't know what intel you're talking about. And then secondarily, you discuss how President Trump has himself said he actually would like to talk to Iran in some level. He would want to bring them back to the negotiating table. While there doesn't seem to be an actual strategy to make this happen, just this sort of, you know, back and forth escalatory measures by Iran and the United States, do you view that as likely to eventually get Iran to the negotiating table with President Trump, or as pushing them away further such that we won't, there's no possible hope of that in any point in the near term?
Yeah, so the question of allies has been really critical in the Iran context over the past 3 years. And I think actually one of the more damaging parts of the current Iran policy has been to alienate allies and isolate us in a way that was previously sort of, you know, unthinkable, right? The Europeans were very much opposed to us withdrawing from the JCPOA. They had advocated for, they had essentially tried to lobby the administration not to follow through and not to pull out of the JCPOA, saying that they did share the same concerns that we have, and I think that is largely the case still today, where they are also troubled by Iran's ballistic missile program. They're also very much troubled by Iranian interventions in the region, particularly in Syria, where Iran has played a really negative, quite devastating role, really, in supporting the Assad regime. And they're also concerned, of course, about the nuclear deal falling through and Iran restarting elements of its nuclear program as it's threatened to do. Now, That's important for several reasons, obviously, broadly, because allies are a key cornerstone of of U.S. Security, national security and foreign policy. But also because if we're trying to get the Iranians back to the table, as President Trump has indicated, then we need the Europeans on board and we need them to work with us. And to kind of dive into your second question here, President Trump, I think, in the past couple of weeks has made a more overt effort of reaching out to the Iranians, of saying, listen, you know, this became a meme on Twitter, but he was essentially indicating to the Iranians that he wants to talk to them. You know, give me a call. Let's chat. Let's try to settle some of these issues. And the Iranians responded by saying, you know, we're not interested in negotiations. The Supreme Leader said a few days later that he viewed negotiations as a poison and that he was not willing to reenter negotiations. Others within the Iranian government have been a bit more nuanced. They've said, look, you know, we're open to negotiations, but only if the United States comes back to the JCPOA. We will negotiate, but only in the context of the JCPOA. I'm thinking specifically of the Iranian foreign minister, Zarif, who made statements to this effect. Now, my read on this whole thing is that the Iranians are interested in negotiating eventually. I think they understand that there needs to be some sort of settlement with the United States. If they want their economy to recover, if they want to be able to do business with the rest of the world. The challenge is that right now, if they come back to the negotiating table, they look weak. They look like they've capitulated. They look like they've been subjugated by the United States. You know, they would essentially be bending the knee, right? And that is not something they're interested in doing, both for historical reasons, but also for just kind of, you know, political reasons. And so my view is that they're still trying to wait out the Trump administration. They're trying to see what happens in November 2020. If President Trump gets a second term, then they will have to think through all of their options, and they'll have to think through and they'll have to consider negotiations very seriously, because 6 years like this is going to be pretty challenging. Or at that point, 4 more years would be really challenging.
I hope negotiations are still on the table in November of 2020. You've given us a lot to think about, and unfortunately, we need to wrap up this segment here. But we've got lots of things to watch, both sort of tactical military maneuvers, but also these big picture discussions or statements from senior leaders. So we hope to have you back on soon to discuss all of that, and we'll get look forward to your insights both here and in the press. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Well, let's move back into keeping up foreign relations and revisit a topic we had a few weeks ago, which is around the world elections. We have follow-up on the Indian elections. Radha, what's going on there?
So on May 23rd, the Indians will conclude about 39 days of voting. So it's a pretty long multi-stage election process. It's looking like from basically every single exit poll that exists, the BJP, which is the current leadership party and headed by President Modi, will win again. So as a reminder for everyone, they're the Hindu nationalists, like Hindu First agenda. President Modi has a large social media following, and so it's not super surprising that he's winning. He's won. He won by a pretty good margin, though not quite as large a margin as he won in 2014. So something, but I think they'll pick up they're guessing about 290 to 300 seats out of the 550, slightly fewer than 550 total seats. The second party sort of down the chain is the Congress Party. And they did better than in 2014, but it's a solid loss with the BJP solidly in power. So I think people largely are seeing this as an affirmation of Modi's Hindu nationalist agenda. It hasn't been great economic conditions and jobs conditions overall in India, but certainly some for the various constituencies that support him. The good news, at least in this election, was there was relatively high female turnout. There was less, though not no, violence. So, you know, It's something.
Take it as we go. Yes. And we also have election results from Australia, which by contrast were quite surprising. And Australia sort of lives in this world of very important ally who most national security professionals overlook or don't pay a great deal of attention to most of the time. But they've had a very sporty political culture, political season these last few years with a fair amount of turnover in their prime ministership. But the Conservative Party has held on. Is that right?
Yeah. It was supposed to be this like climate election with the sort of popular voting in of a left-wing agenda aimed at reducing the impact of various human-related activities related to climate change. And basically, it seems like the economic pitch from the Conservative Party might have been sort of more persuasive overall than this climate agenda, or at least less disperse. And so here we are with the Conservative majority party. So let's
we'll see how something. Long that lasts. Unlike most weeks, well, I mean, maybe some weeks are like this. The the real drama is in our trade segment. It's aghast. And we have new Chinese tariffs. We had a deal that people thought was about to get signed. And then
we have all the things.
We have all of the things. So, Radha, what do you want to start with? You want to start up with Xi walking away from the table, and or?
Why don't we start with some our sort of process is our Valentine moment here, which I will lay out, but I will be very interested in everyone's thoughts and interpretations on this. So basically what happened is the U.S. thought we were really close to a deal. They sent over language that they thought was going to be the final language, and it came back in a, quote, sea of red, referring to the track changes from the Chinese in the proposed trade deal. And the thought is that this was really Xi himself directing these changes, walked back.
The Chinese premier.
Correct. Walked back agreements in basically all of the major areas of contention, which were intellectual property rights, encouraging foreign investment, and a commitment to buy foreign goods. So basically all of the things that they thought they had gotten agreements on.
Wow.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. It's not great, guys. It's not great. And there's a lot of big questions as to why, whether the Chinese thought sort of Trump's eagerness to sign a deal meant that they had more leverage than maybe they did, and they thought they could make more changes, whether there were some intra-party squabbles where some of the more hardline or some of the sort of party leadership hadn't been tracking and hadn't been kept as closely up to speed. But there's an interesting spate of articles also that talk about, frankly, the insufficient policy process on both the Chinese and the U.S. side, where the negotiators were looking at English language deals, sort of going back and forth with the trade negotiators, but weren't sort of running the internal intra-agency process, both on this side and that side, with lawyers reviewing the content in their native language to make sure they sort of comported with national interests. And when that started to happen, you ended up with a lot of red line edits. So, you know, process was not their Valentine, I think.
So then Trump threatened, subsequent to that sort of redlining deal coming back, Trump threatened to increase tariffs, which we then did. So we levied an additional, what was it, $25 billion in trade taxes, which I should let you know that many NPR commentators are now using trade taxes instead of tariffs.
I've noticed that, and I feel so proud when I see that.
I totally attribute it to Radha, yep. And also appreciate that that's easier to spell because I always get tariff wrong.
I know. Like, in my heart of hearts, I just don't believe that tariff should have the number of Fs and Rs it actually has. Yep. So, you know,
I always want to put two L's in battalion. So what are you going to do?
Yeah, so we're taxing all the goods.
So, Radha, what's the next step here in terms of, like, are they going back to the negotiating table? Are they saying, like, okay, this didn't work? What's the likely process to follow up on this?
So we're not totally sure. Trump has indicated a willingness to talk to Xi. They should, in principle, see each other next month at the G20 summit. So there's some potential for that. I think some of this also depends a little on what the Chinese retaliation looks like. So the Chinese increased tariffs on U.S. goods. They only have about $6 billion worth of goods to tax relative to our $300 billion goods that we're sort of putting the new tariffs on. So there's a little bit of a mismatch there.
Because we import more from them than they import from us, which is the sort of crux of Trump's frustration here in general.
Correct. Yes. Correct. But just as a reminder, they can do lots of other things that are not great for us or the global economy. So right. the most likely things are changes in their currency value and currency devaluation, which is the sort of thing that's freaking out the markets right now. The other things they could do, though, which will come to what the U.S. doing with Huawei, is target U.S. companies that have to operate in China. So they could do anything from just slow walking licensing and approvals that U.S. companies need to operate in China and just like make it harder for those companies to operate, to actually just like arbitrarily finding them because they wanna, which is a thing that the Chinese government has done but doesn't tend to do in the past. I think the big fear that's probably not likely, but certainly would be a problem, is if they decide to dump U.S. treasuries.
Right.
That would be... they hold a lot of and would cause sort of massive economic issues. But, you know, this issue of finding and targeting U.S. companies, I think, is one that's very much on the table, especially in this post Huawei moment.
Yes. So let's talk about Huawei, because you know how much I love that.
Yes.
So I missed this in real time, but there was an executive order issued last week.
Sure was.
Under the International Emergency Economics Power Act, which I think you should definitely be involved in at some point, Radha, because that sounds like totally your jam. And what I didn't realize, when I saw it sort of briefly, I understood it to be, you know, basically regulating the use of Huawei technologies in domestic U.S. networks. And that sort of made sense to me, and I didn't have a huge amount of objection. But then it put a whole bunch of export regulations on companies who do business with Huawei. And so that could include, for example, Google Android OS going on Huawei phones, not for use in the U.S., but in any other country around the world. That struck me as fairly escalatory. Did I read that right? Or is that like actually a BFD?
So I think it's a big deal. I think you have read it right, with the caveat that, like many things, what we're really waiting for is the Commerce Department to issue the standards that will implement the Trump executive order.
So they have 150 days to issue the regs,
exactly.
Right? Okay.
That's right. And so that will kind of give us a sense of what is actually covered and banned under this order, and also what things are not. It will also tell us which company, it will give us a sense of which companies are most likely impacted, both in the supply chain sense, so they use Huawei products to as inputs to their goods, and which companies are going to be, if any, will be impacted in this trade lines ban.
So as I was reading about this, I was surprised. Huawei buys basically $11 billion worth of goods from U.S. businesses. That's like billion with a B. That is a non-trivial amount of trade. And, you know, is a huge consumer then of a number of U.S. products. So,
which is why in concept in these regulations, it will likely include the potential for a number of waivers to be issued for this. And I have to imagine that in this process, there's some technical matters being discussed, but also more political ones in terms of like, how much do we actually want to wreck our own economy or wreck some of our own companies in the process of trying to get Huawei out of our shores.
Right. And it's just worth noting that Huawei, it is a leader in this sort of 5G technology, and a lot of the security risks have focused in that area. They actually do a huge amount of telecom sort of R&D and investment, and all of that is subject to sort of Chinese government pressure and does sort of face security risks. So there's a complicated interplay of both the 5G network adoption and discussion of that happening, and the sort of broader existing supply chains that a lot of the tech companies have sort of built in an interdependent way that would just have direct immediate impact. We don't have to wait for 5G for this to be a really meaningful executive order.
Okay, Roger, real quickly, tell me about aluminum tariffs.
Yeah, really quickly, We're going to maybe drop them. We think we've got a deal, but only with Canada and Mexico. So guys, you smacka. It's going to happen.
Oh my gosh. Excellent.
But we're not going to help the Europeans on this. So that's kind of where it stands.
Okay. White House mayhem. We have a number of topics. Very quickly, we can say that Patrick Shanahan has finally formally been nominated to be Secretary of Defense. I myself am a little bit surprised, both because I thought that if he wasn't nominated soon, he wouldn't get nominated at all. And he had horrible showings on Capitol Hill. So his confirmation hearings could be fairly interesting, although I don't think his confirmation is in doubt at this point. The Senate Armed Services Committee seems to be on board. But we won't have an acting SecDef here once he's confirmed. So that's something.
So in fairness, bad SecDef hearings are not like, remember Chuck Hagel's hearings? I'm just saying, like,
but that wasn't anticipated to be bad. That was what was fascinating about Chuck Hagel's hearing, is that everyone assumed that this would be a fairly straightforward and easy hearing. It was not. In this case, we've already had, I mean, not only the SASC chairman come out previously and be like, I'm not really sure about this whole Shanahan guy. I believe I saw Senator Blumenthal also said that it was the weakest SecDef nomination we had ever had in history. Like, this guy is not facing a warm and fuzzy audience, and I assume they'll be looking to maybe humiliate him a little bit in the context of his confirmation hearing.
And he could have to answer some interesting questions in that hearing, I think, particularly with regards to some of the president's recent statements on issuing pardons for service members convicted of war crimes. So this has been out mostly in Twitter and elsewhere over the last few days, but the president plans to pardon a number of service members, including Special Operations Chief Edward Gallagher, on Memorial Day. And this, I don't know. I mean, this actually, this strikes a lot of people, I think, as particularly awful. It has a lot of civil military implications, but there are a number of folks who are going to have to answer for this or answer about this in confirmation, you know, hearings coming up, to include both Secretary Shanahan, but also we'll have some new service chiefs coming in the line here later this summer and fall. And I would expect them to be asked about it as well. But how did this strike you when you heard about it?
And I just to put a fine point on this, in order to pardon them, these are not people who are accused of crimes that haven't been through a formal process. These are people, like in the case of Chief Gallagher, who actually had multiple members from his own group turn him in, testify against him, and then you know, he was convicted. So it's a pretty serious set of criminal violations, leaving aside the war crime part, just the crime part, to be pardoning in this sort of way.
Yeah, there's a range of people that they're looking to pardon. They also include a former Blackwater contractor who was one of few people that was actually convicted for a spate of crimes that Blackwater was accused of in Iraq. Gallagher's trial process is actually still ongoing in terms of appeals, and they were his attorney reported to be surprised that the president was considering this. If you don't watch Fox News, or if you're not a consumer of conservative radio or otherwise, this is probably fairly surprising to you that this is on the president's radar at all. But seeking pardons or talking about the miscarriage of justice as against service members who are accused of war crimes or other related criminal activity is a pretty frequent topic in the right-wing press. And as I've tweeted about and said otherwise, like, there are probably some cases where it's worthwhile to highlight that there are, I hate to use this phrase, but effectively fog of war questions around some of the accusations and convictions that have gone on, not amongst the group that is being considered here, but in a broader set of how we think about war crimes. In the cases that the president is ostensibly considering, there's not a lot of question. It appears to be more that he has decided that because these acts were committed, and they're fairly heinous, committed in war, therefore they're totally fine, and we should be celebrating these gentlemen. And he's retweeted multiple...
A term we're going to use loosely.
Yeah, these men. He's tweeted about their service and their patriotism before. So I would very much want to hear from the service chiefs about this. If I got a camera or a microphone in any of their faces as a journalist in the next couple of weeks, this would be item number one. Like, how are you addressing this matter with your commander in chief? Dunford ostensibly holds his fire with the president pretty often and doesn't push on him in terms of advice. If Dunford isn't using his last months in office to address this issue, I don't really know what to say in terms of his tenure.
I would also just say, like, from my perspective and sort of just taking a slight step back, the idea that we would do this and then still expect reasonable status of forces agreements when we deploy troops to various places under the idea that we prosecute violations of international law and criminal acts on our own, and thus we should not subject our military forces to local law enforcement, is just, like, I don't know how we would have a credible way to negotiate that status of force agreement anywhere globally ever. They're always controversial. There are always issues that come up of local law enforcement. It's a really, like, there's a long tail on doing things like this when even when it's a small number of service members or former service members, and even when not all of them are necessarily service members at the time, as in the case of the Blackwater case. I think there's a lot of sort of spillover potential from this that's pretty risky.
There's also, this probably seems a little far out from people who don't track these matters frequently, but this puts real stress on a lot of our alliances, where you might have, you know, Britain, the UK, other NATO members might engage in a lot of what they would call caveat inserting process, where they would say, like, we will not allow our forces to deploy in combat missions with US forces because of the risk of them being witness to or participants in possible war crimes. And like, that sounds a little insane, but if you've ever observed the NATO caveat process in practice, there's far lesser things that they will not allow their forces to be engaged in because they're freaked out about US forces or US objectives in some way. This is a big deal in terms of us operating with allies in the future.
It's also just anathema to the Uniform Code of Military Justice and the idea that there is a profession of arms that is a distinct from wanton applications of violence. And that has been, I think, fairly important to folks as they've deployed and engaged in counterinsurgency, engaged in counterterrorism, the idea that there is a law of war, a code of conduct, a code of military justice that informs and constrains U.S. military behavior. And if that's not the case, then you have a real set of dilemmas about the use of force, both at the strategic but also at the tactical levels. I mean, I find this to be particularly egregious and hope that it leads to a pretty large outcry. But I think a lot of folks may side with the president, which is to say, you know, that they're going to, you know, side with, you know, they're not going to choose to question deployed troops, and that this is, remedying some particular set of, I don't know, their concerns that they've been mistreated. That said, there's no objection to the actual, any part of the UCMJ that was applied here, to any particular element of the, you know, if you were actually filing an appellate case, you know, there's nothing that you would appeal necessarily on procedural grounds, at least not that I've read about. So the point here is being basically, we don't think this was bad, so we're going to continue to allow it. And I think that is a really horrible decision, both on its face and for the longer term reasons that you both are highlighting. Okay, pop culture. Are either of you actually watching Game of Thrones? Are we just reading spoilers? What is going on over there?
I'm just reading spoilers. Sorry. It's the same thing.
So is Radha.
It's the same thing. I can still talk about it.
I mean, really what I need to know is what the interagency process is that's going on in the, you know, Danny John War Council, because it seems to be fairly fraught.
Danny appears to be effectuating her role as, you know, commander in chief, quite literally, in the sense that she is the head of the future, I guess, head of state of the state, while also apparently changing their battle plans midstream, while she decided to go ahead and destroy King's Landing, which, I don't know, kind of seems like destroying the place where your throne is supposed to be. It seems like an odd choice to me, not one I necessarily would have made, but hey, to each their own.
Yeah, it just seems like they needed some more time to really, you know, work out that whole Bell's surrender situation and, you know, and or establish an objective for this, you know, battle they were about to fight. But perhaps, you know.
Right. I kept wondering, like, what's the rush here? Like, could you just wait a couple of weeks or maybe a day? Like, is there something that's pushing you to go after Cersei this quickly such that you cannot actually have a conversation with, like, hey, let's maybe not war crime here, or not war crime a lot. Crazy idea.
So with the caveat that all of my Game of Thrones information is drawn from reading spoilers on the internet and not watching the show, because this is how I'm going to participate in pop culture henceforth and forevermore. my big kind of constant confusion is one that Lauren has come up with, which is, it's not clear what drives the pacing on, I mean, like, I don't mean the pacing of the writing, though I do have some follow-up questions for the writers on that myself, but the pacing of the actual shows in these types of, like, wars, exactly as Lauren says, like, why, what are we doing here? What are the goals? And do we really need to burn, like, everything down to get there?
Friend of the show, Nani Hall Singh, shared a link that talked about the difference between pantsers and plotters. And so he talked about sort of George Martin, who wrote the original Game of Thrones books, and for which everybody is waiting for the final book or books, is a pantser. He writes by the seat of his pants instead of goes where the characters take him. And so everything kind of emerges organically. And the current showrunners for the TV show Game of Thrones on HBO are plotters. They know where they need to get to, and they just sort of force action in order to get there. Now, I don't know that either of those archetypes are exactly right, but none of the behavior of the protagonists this season have been particularly well motivated. For example, they wanted to show the point of view of somebody wandering around the streets in King's Landing during the battle, so they had Arya wander around, even though Arya knows every nook and cranny of the Red Keep herself and could have come out through a tunnel. There's no reason why Arya would be like exposed on the streets. So a very minor example. Certainly the frustrations with this season of Game of Thrones are legion. You can find any million number of tweets to document those. And the finale is tonight. And so I look forward to you guys reading the spoilers tomorrow, and then we can all talk about it.
Perfect.
Excellent. I'm also very excited about the new Rocket Man movie, which has Taron Egerton as Elton John. And that's basically like a total wheelhouse sort of thing for me. Like, I'm very on board for all of those things.
I will say, in case you were worried, I am keeping up with The Spanish Princess. But more importantly, last night I watched a movie, Romancing the Stone, which I don't know if folks have seen recently. But guys, it's amazing.
Have you never
seen it? I feel like there's a lot to be learned. No, of course not. I'm Rana. And it was such a good time.
The sequel is not as good, I hate to tell you.
Oh, man.
But you should watch it anyway.
I'm going to watch it tonight, but that's a shame. Because it was amazing.
Any other pop culture?
Yeah, just a small thing. I have talked about one of my favorite books on this show a number of times, The Winds of War by Herman Welk. Herman Welk passed away at the age of 103.
I believe
it was today, possibly yesterday. I'm not sure the timeline. There is a wonderful remembrance of him by David Frum in The Atlantic that was written a few years ago about the huge body of work he did, particularly around World War II, and just really embodying what it felt like to be a regular person, a person in the Navy, somebody who was under threat in Europe, on the ground during that conflict, and his battle writing, particularly for the Battle of Midway, is just excellent. So go take a look at David Frum's piece, but also pick up Winds of War if you've not ever done so before.
Wonderful. All right, that's it for this week. See everybody next time. Bye.